Welcome to Drinkful and Descend.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Hey, Cameron. What's up, man? How are you?
Pretty good, man. Part 15 was awesome, and I feel like things are just rolling.
They're totally rolling. I feel like each episode kind of gets a little bit more intense at this point, and I'm loving that it's so action-packed here as we're winding down.
We're well on the way to getting what I've always hoped for, which was a finale that is just batshit crazy.
Yeah, which I think is going to
I think it's going to happen.
Yeah. So speaking of batshit crazy, this episode starts after... no offense. The episode starts with, of course, we get our opening shot of the trees,
detail
on the trees.
Of the trees and the mountains.
And the mountains. We actually see the Twin Peaks in this episode to start us off.
And then we get our friend Nadine sort of marching down the street, carrying her golden shovel.
She is possibly Jacoby's first foot soldier marching down the street.
Yeah,
with
I was thinking about that when I saw this. Of course, we come to find out where she's headed is to Big Ed's gas farm.
Yeah.
To tell Big Ed that she's better. She's been a selfish bitch all these years.
She's been a selfish bitch. She's changed. Mm. She admits that, you know, that Ed has been so good to her, and that he stayed with her and gave up his love. She says, God, even knowing,
so good.
So
I've been digging my way out of the shit.
Yeah. And Ed, in somewhere in there, says, you've been watching Jacoby's show? So
you know I
knows.
Have. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. You know I have.
I like Nadine.
Yeah. But he says basically that Ed is free. He can run to Norma, run to her, she says. Enjoy the rest of your lives, giving Ed the freedom to finally go and grab Norma and hopefully fall in love and get married and be with Norma.
Yeah, so then basically we follow Ed, and the Otis Redding comes in here, right? Even as he's driving?
Yep. So, I mean, she specifically thanks Dr. Amp, and maybe there's a couple of things to mention there where she's giving Ed his freedom. She says, go and enjoy. She thanks Dr. Amp. One thought that occurred to me was the last time that we see her is when she's with Jacoby, and he has stopped to admire her window dressing, right?
Yeah.
And also the question of, is that golden shovel she's carrying the one from her window display?
Yeah, I kind of thought it was, and I thought that was where she was walking from.
Okay.
I guess we don't know for sure.
Yeah, and here's one question I had to you. Did you get the sense of asking yourself, where is she walking to after this? Because I kind of felt like, okay, Nadine, what are you about to do that you're finally giving Ed away, and you took the shovel out of your window, and we just heard you say you're going to be a foot soldier for Jacoby.
Well, I've been wondering about where the two of them have been living, because they used to, on the original series at least, live like right by the
right,
gas
across farm. The street even. Yeah.
I don't know if it was across the street or next door.
Okay.
I don't know if it was ever even clear, but it was like right there.
Right.
And it doesn't seem like that's the case. Nadine, I'm thinking, is living in her store or by her store. I don't know, but this is the moment of her giving Ed his freedom. It's like, go to Norma.
Yeah.
Love is about giving the person what they want.
Exactly.
Right, which is
And she
nice.
Does credit Dr. Amp, so I feel like through his show or his, like, kind of fake half psychology, he has maybe advised Nadine to do this. And I did have the question in my mind, since we just last saw them together, is Nadine getting over Ed because of Jacoby in some way, more than just Jacoby's advice, possibly?
Maybe.
So we don't know, but... very, very interesting. This is also one of those key moments where, even as a viewer, you're like Ed, right? You're like, whoa, what? Are you really saying this time, Nadine?
And Ed makes sure. He's like, you're going to regret this tomorrow, honey.
You better really think about this. And she's like, no, I'm sure. I walked all the way here, so I had time to turn back.
Yeah. Well, then I love, when Ed arrives at the Double R, we've got the Otis Redding song.
Oh, geez.
I've been loving you.
This is so good. So it's a beautiful song. It's one of those, it pulls on your heart songs, of course.
And but when he first walks in, he's got a smile on his face. He waves at Norma, but he
gets her and he says to her, I've just talked to Nadine, and she's given me my freedom.
Everything's changed now.
But Norma interrupts him a bit.
Yeah, and I kind of saw this coming.
Yeah,
I was like, this is gonna break my heart again.
Yeah,
she's like, sorry, Walter's here. And then he says, Walter says, did you get my flowers? And they go to sit down. Ed sits at the counter.
Yeah.
And ask Shelley for a coffee.
And a cyanide tablet.
Yeah. After she walks away.
So a couple things to point out. This song is coming in and out throughout this scene. And we see that kind of in the moments where it's in, right after what you just mentioned, Ed closes his eyes and he kind of enters this meditative state even. Mm-hmm. The coffee is served to him. We've seen him in a couple booths down before when Walter and Norma were speaking, and I kind of got the hunch then that he was trying to listen in, maybe he has good hearing. Yeah. And in this moment, I kind of think, okay, is he hearing what they're saying, what they're discussing?
Yeah, I didn't read it that way. I thought he was.
Or is he just meditating on love,
like,
kind of thing?
Meditative but despondent posture was how I read it.
Yeah.
Like he's closing his eyes, trying to, you know, not actually go kill himself.
Yeah.
Like when he says
exactly.
The thing about the cyanide tablet, then he's like, okay, no, collect, you know, don't like break down or whatever. So it was a little bit of a heartbreak. We go back to Norma and Walter, though, and very quickly find out that Norma is looking to...
She wants to exercise her option to get paid. She's now admitting to him, like, look, I don't want to be part of this franchise anymore.
Yeah, you can buy my shares, buy the franchises.
And
I just
whatever the contract made was, she made sure to keep some option in it that said, you know, when I want... You buy me out, and I do keep the original double R diamond.
Yeah, and of course, Walter's aghast at this. You know, she says family reasons, which is interesting because, you know, Walter says, well, I thought you didn't have a family. Yeah.
Right.
Right?
Let's talk about Norma's family for a second. So, of course, there's a thing with Hank that was kind of the parallel of Big Ed and Nadine, where they were kind of, Ed and Norma were kind of both with someone else. That was their second choice.
Of course, Hank had gone back to prison at the end of the original series.
Right.
And if you've read The Secret History, that says he was killed in prison.
Yeah.
Hank's out of the picture.
Yeah.
Annie.
We don't.
How's Annie?
Yeah. How's Annie?
We have gotten no new information about, right? Recalling that she was supposedly Norma's sister.
Yeah.
Right.
So what is the last thing we've seen her? If we include the missing pieces, we've seen her in a hospital recovering and the ring getting taken from her finger.
And that was it.
And that was it. Mm-hmm. So
and of
we
course,
can presume many things, but we don't know.
She's
about
not
any.
Mentioned at all in The Secret History,
yeah.
Which is one of the weird things or inconsistencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Norma's relationship with her mother, which is rather tendentious in the original series, right?
I
remember her mother was the food critic who gave them a bad review and all of that, you know?
But she stands strong against Walter, and she now realizes that she wants the double R and only the double R. And she says, I have my family here. I want to take care of them.
Yeah.
And of course, she's speaking about Shelley and all her friends and the people that she works with, and even Toad.
Presumably,
you know.
Yeah. And part of what I really enjoyed about this scene, Mike, is how it really played like a breakup.
Yeah.
You know,
they're talking about business, but they're really
only talking about business.
This is how it was before when he first meets her. You're like, what is this, a business relationship? But you've also managed to kind of link this to a romantic relationship. And why does that work?
I mean, it's at least clear that once the business relationship is over, so is whatever romantic thing.
Yeah.
You know, and again, Walter's character, he just can't understand this. He says that, right, as we talked about before, this kind of guy who, you know, thinks about everything in terms of profit and profitability, right? And love doesn't always turn a profit, I think he said in that earlier scene.
And
right?
Now he says, I think you're making a huge mistake. And then he walks out the second she says that, right? So even though this is more subtle and it's playing up to, like, logical business, paperwork kind of stuff, it does remind me of Truck You saying, you know what, lady, if I don't get my way, then fuck you.
Well, and Walter thinks she's making a huge mistake because she is choosing love over profit.
Exactly.
Right? In a fairly direct way.
Right.
Yeah.
And then so he gets up and he leaves at this. And then the song, we see Ed again. The song comes back in as it's hitting us in these waves.
And I love the
And of course,
the
song, itself, it's right in this part, the build up to Otis.
And
of course, the great Otis Redding singing this.
I don't know if it's quite foreshadowed or if it's just you want it to happen so bad.
And you've been wanting this to happen for so long.
I'm talking in particular about. We linger with Ed, and then the first thing we see is her hand coming up on his shoulder, right?
Yeah.
I know.
His eyes are closed. He has, like, this slight pressed smile.
I hope Norma comes over.
Which is
what? Puts her hand on his shoulder. Like, precisely what I wanted to happen.
Please let that happen. And he's in that moment of meditation, and, like, I got the feeling the first time I watched it, like, okay, so he's, hold on, Ed, we don't know what's going to happen here. Yeah. Don't let this, it reminded me of Romeo and Juliet or something, the cyanide pill. I'm going to kill myself, but yet I didn't have that bit of information yet, knowing, wait, she did love me. So it was almost set up there for a minute to be like the death of Romeo and Juliet, you know. But, of course, the moment the hand with that song comes onto his shoulder and you
so
just
quick.
Melt.
I think my notes over here say he asks her to marry him. She says, of course, they embrace and the audience cries.
Yeah, and the audience cries. Yeah, exactly. Where it's the tears of joy. Yeah. And of course, as we're going to get into it more, this episode is an episode of emotional strain. Mm-hmm. Tears of joy and sadness and everything. But there's this moment here, right, where we see them kiss. We see Shelley looking on, and, yeah, and all of Shelley's thoughts about, wow, cool, they're going to get back together. Mm-hmm. And then so we get that recognition. It reminds us that Shelley's in this relationship with Red. Mm-hmm. We have now seen Norma get rid of Walter and get back with Ed.
Yeah.
And, so we picture what Shelley might be thinking about all this. And then it cuts from that to show kind of Twin Peaks itself, the double R. We go outside and we see the trees and then the sky. Yeah. And then, of course, the close-up to the sky and the clouds moving with Otis still singing.
Linger with us so long. It's and we get the feeling. The joy of Ed and Norma.
Yeah, and you get the feeling that, like, love is enough. It's like answering Briggs's question that love is enough. And I felt Twin Peaks and the region around the woods themselves are charged up with good energy from the love of Norma and Ed. And it's such a cool feeling.
And then they fade to black. It's a slow cut here.
Yeah.
But of course, the next thing we get is these dark, staticky power lines.
Yeah. Oh, don't think it's all good in the world of Twin Peaks because, here's this energy.
Yeah.
And it's also the same kind of footage we see in Andy's vision in the previous episode where we're traveling below the lines.
I think this was the same footage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's this dark energy, it's this electrical signal traveling down the lines, the power lines.
Right, and then to the kind of Lost Highway shot.
Yep, nighttime road, like straight headlights. In front of you, you don't know where you're kind of entering into the darkness, you can only see so far ahead.
Which at this point, they've basically made a visual cue that we're going to get Mr. C, I think, right?
And then, there's the reverse shot, and we see Mr. C driving, and he pulls up to the convenience store. And here we're seeing... Real world, big giant truck with Mr. C driving up off of whatever the address of the road that there is actually a convenience store here.
Yeah, there's a convenience. We don't know exactly where we are. There's a woodsman there we see and the some notes from the Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima.
Exactly.
We start getting that in the soundtrack again.
Mm-hmm. So he pulls up to this convenience store. When he approaches the convenience store with the woodsman, he sort of starts to follow the woodsman up the staircase that we talked about before.
Right, the staircase that doesn't really seem to lead to anything.
And, of course, previously in Fire Walk With Me, it's been referenced above. Philip Gerard says, I used to be with Bob above the convenience store, right?
Mm-hmm.
I lived with him above the convenience store.
Or I think there's a reference in the first season, even.
Right.
When they, anyway.
Yeah.
Regardless, this notion of them meeting above the convenience store, right, that scene from Fire Walk With Me with Philip Jeffries and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they get to the top of the stairs and they just kind of like flicker and it's staticky and then they sort of disappear into the...
Yeah, there's the crackling sound of electrical. They disappear.
Other dimensional space.
There's an overlay here. You see them kind of going through the woods into a house... with the floral print wallpaper that we've seen before.
Yeah, and they kind of overlay those images, right? And there's all of this kind of flickering kind of stuff going on, right? And so they go in there. He says, I'm looking for Jeffries. And we've got another woodsman who pulls that, like, crank.
Yeah, so what looks like an old, to me it looked like an old tube radio that has the front ripped off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Could possibly be a television that had tubes behind it, but I didn't see like a big CRT tube or something. It seemed to me it was a radio. But it was definitely old classical turn of the century radio technology with tubes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he pulls a lever on it and there's the sound, again, the sound design Lynch is doing is amazing.
Oh, it's great. We get the electricity and so on. And then also mixed in here visually is at least a quick shot of our friend, the Jumping Man.
Yeah, Jumping Man, whom we saw in Fire Walk With Me. That's got the strange white mask on with the long nose. And also like kind of jittering and moving in some awkward way.
Yeah, and I wonder if we will see him more. People have had an eye out for this as one character who was on the cast list we hadn't seen yet.
Yeah.
This could be it.
Could be.
But definitely worth noting.
So then we get a big woodsman with a big long beard, which I think is the same woodsman that has killed Bill Hastings.
I am pretty sure this is the guy who killed Bill Hastings.
And he appears and he kind of like looks at Mr. C and you get the idea that he's supposed to go with him. So Mr. C follows him down this hallway. And this is an interesting shot because as they're going down this hallway, you do see some more overlaid video. You see maybe some curtains for a second, and then more dark woods, as you say.
Yeah, the dark woods and the curtains almost seemed like they were the same thing.
Yeah. These kind of really rippling layers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because they're, you know, the idea I was getting is like, okay, so they're walking through two different spatial areas at the same time, and it's trans-dimensional. You know, is he jumping through space-time to be at literally at another place on Earth? Or, yeah, you know, what kind of weird space are they walking through to get to the end of this hallway?
I don't know, but they do a good amount of walking. They go up another staircase, which looked to me like the staircase Cole saw.
Yeah, I thought so too. This was a staircase from the vortex that Cole and Al that
with
saw.
With the dirty bearded men.
Yeah.
On
dirty
a staircase.
Dirty bearded men in a room. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so they go up that and they go through another door and then into this like dark, dingy motel. Right?
Yeah. Again, a strange spatial relation transition where they go through this door that's up the stairs there and it opens to exterior parking lot motel, small, trashy motel.
Yeah,
that you felt that you recognized, right?
Well, apparently, and I'm going to give a little hat tip here to Ghostwood Design on Twitter because that was my source.
Yeah.
Apparently, this is the same motel where Leland met Teresa.
Oh, I see. It does look like it. Yeah, that kind of roadside motel we see often. That it's like the hotel is a perimeter, a quad around a parking lot kind of to set up.
Yeah, and it's the same set, I guess.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah, and the over-the-shoulder shot we see that you can tell it's kind of really dark here. There's other woodsmen that are, like, walking with Mr. C, kind of leading him toward the corner of the spot where we can see the only hotel room, which is number 8, that has a light lit up above it.
Yep.
And, of course, I don't know, this is just a symbol, but and could be used in all kinds of ways. It does remind me of something along lines of, like, triggering a sign, maybe the Underground Railroad or something like that, but a sign using a light or the Paul Revere story or something like that. But anyway, so there's one light lit. That's the one he goes to, and he tries to open it, but it's locked.
And the door's locked. And then this sort of strange figure approaches. In the credits says, Bosomy Woman.
Bosomy Woman approaches.
Rather odd.
Yes, very odd.
And apparently the actor here is a man. I don't know. I don't know what to do with any of that.
I thought it was particularly how details change with distance, right? As the character is approaching the camera, that you get more detail, and suddenly at first in the distance, I thought maybe it was like Beulah or something.
Right.
Like, okay, here's a witch figure. And the way that Lynch set up the lighting for this shot is really kind of creepy. You
it
just
was
get
also,
the idea that there's
I felt like,
something
her
off.
Face was almost intentionally kind of blurred.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Is it, or not in full focus. Or
something. Approaching focus as the actor walked toward the camera.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And she says in that backwards-y lodge speak, you know, I'll unlock it for you.
I'll unlock the door for you. He starts to and does open room number 8 up for Mr. C. Mr. C steps in. There's a strange lamp as, you know, can't have any kind of strange sequence happen without a weird lamp.
Gotta have the lamps. Just want a house full of all these lamps.
Yeah. And there's a big, tall, standing floor lamp, but there's also, like, some overhead fluorescent lights that are flickering and strobing, which adds to the tension of the scene.
And we see a radiator, right?
Yeah, it's, we see Mr. C's perspective. He's looking at the wall, and we see just a standard blank wall with a radiator. And then it kind of, like, peels away.
Yeah, the editing effect here we were talking about a little bit. I don't know exactly how to describe it.
Very strange at first. It was like, welcome to the funhouse. Let's peel that wall away that you thought was a static wall, you know, but... What really is extra weird about this is that once the wall and the radiator peel away, the radiator continually is overlaid flashing in and out of existence, even on top of what we're seeing.
Yeah, but then we get a kind of bell-shaped thing, maybe reminding us of, in part, some of the things we saw back in part 3, what have you. the steam kind of coming out into an orb.
Yeah, there's a little teapot kettle kind of like spout, right? And
really,
then it's like spewing steam out into an orb that's lit up.
And really strong Eraserhead vibes here.
Yeah, reminded me of Eraserhead. And of course, this is also a callback to, as you called it, the Eraserhead space station.
Yeah, the Eraserhead spaceship too. Yeah, so, but I mean the steam, right? We're thinking about the steam thing with the baby and Eraserhead, the radiator, the woman in the radiator. I mean, like... Just the visual language here I found very, very reminiscent of Eraserhead.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But this is Philip Jeffries.
Yeah. So you hear this tea kettle thing. And again, we don't know. Is this the embodiment of Jeffries? Is this the somehow the mechanistic vehicle that Jeffries needs to speak to Mr. C through another dimension? You know, it's so weird.
I don't know.
What are we looking at here?
But this is Jeffries. And he says, oh, it's you.
And Mr. C then acknowledges and says, Jeffries. Yeah. And Jeffries says, oh, thank God. Mr. C says, why did you send Ray to kill me?
And then the response, he says, what?
Yeah,
which sounded to me like a denial.
Right. Like, I haven't heard of that. What?
And then he said, I called Ray.
But then Mr. C says, so you did send him. And
right.
In this accusatory.
It's fucking ambiguous.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
But it says, did you call me 5 days ago trying to hash out? Was that you I was talking to in the hotel, right?
Well, and he says, I don't have your number. So that seems like a no.
And then he says, so it was someone else who called. And, you know, Jeffrey says, we used to talk. And Mr. C says, yes, we did. And then we get the flashback to the fire walk with me scene, right?
Yeah, which Mr. C here dates in 1989.
Yeah.
Which is a little odd.
But you actually see mm-hmm. Bowie's present in this one from the Fire Walk With Me footage. He says, mm-hmm. you know, basically the line where, you know, we're not going to talk about Judy is the focal point.
Yeah, so now we're
that.
Focusing on Judy. After right. last week, people were talking about the fact that they just called our attention to the who do you think that is their line.
Yeah.
And not the Judy stuff.
Exactly.
Oh, now we're getting the Judy
now
stuff.
Now it's Judy.
A lot. Because Mr. Seeker goes, who is Judy?
Yeah, he says, 1989, when you showed up in Philly and you said you met Judy.
Why didn't you want to talk about Judy?
Yeah.
Who is Judy?
And,
does Judy want something from
recognizing
me?
That, Jeffries then says, so you are Cooper.
Yeah.
And so that's a little strange. We've also heard Mr. C be called, we hear him called Cooper in a bit also
but
again.
He is Cooper. No problem for me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he's Cooper's doppelganger. But
right.
But in
this
my mind, that,
that
means
question
he's like,
is part of Cooper is here and present, and
yeah.
his knowledge bank is there and shared with Mr. C.
Yeah, that's sort of always been my reading,
yeah.
I guess, is that. Doppelganger Cooper, Mr. C, is the like dark half
right.
of Cooper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then Mr. C says, Philip, why didn't you want to talk about Judy? Who is Judy? Does she want something from me?
Just ask her yourself. I'll write it down for you.
Yeah, let me write it down for you. And that's really interesting because his
great.
Method of writing down is.
His numbers start appearing in the steam.
Yeah, he's yeah. using the steam, the smoke
we
itself.
Get, 48 degrees. I guess.
Yeah.
And 551 and a period. That's what I saw.
Okay.
I don't know if that's a whole thing, though.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's maybe not the whole thing.
Yeah.
And we just
I wasn't
see the
clear
rest.
100% either. Is this more coordinates? Is this a phone number or?
Yeah, I think it's coordinates because it does look like it says 48 degrees.
Okay. Yeah.
So we might be starting to get longitude and latitude.
I see.
That's what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. But in that case, we're not getting the whole set of coordinates.
Getting these coordinates, Mr. C pulls a little pad and paper out of his pocket, writes them down right away, does ask again, who is Judy?
You've already met Judy.
You've already met Judy?
And man, now...
What do you mean I've already met Judy? And then the phone starts ringing.
Right, but we've got to think about this now.
Yeah.
Who is Judy?
Yeah, there's so many possibilities.
And it
if she's accessible with coordinates and mm-hmm. is somebody that is in this realm of Philip Jeffries... And everyone.
Maybe. I don't know about that even. The way that this was presented got me thinking that Judy is someone we know.
Yeah. But what I mean, not in the physical realm of Philip Jeffries, but what I mean is in related to and knowing somehow connected to Philip Jeffries and Cooper. Mm-hmm. And if that's somebody that's named Judy... Yeah, I don't know. It could be one of the other FBI agents or it was mentioned before that taking Judy to connect to Garland as kind of a code name
yeah,
of Judy Garland talking about Briggs.
That theory is still open, I guess.
Yeah.
I did pay close attention here that we never get a pronoun used. Even.
Yeah. Okay.
It's
right.
always the mm-hmm. name Judy.
Right.
Right. He doesn't say ask her yourself even.
Right.
He says ask Judy mm. yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I did note that. I guess the door's still open to this Garland Briggs theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but it definitely got me thinking about, you know, who could be Judy in terms of characters we're familiar with,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And this might be a good time just to mention, I mean, we talked about this with Woodsman being like the Tin Woodsman. There's a couple other moments in here that we've hearkened to the Wizard of Oz,
Lynch
is, of course, in Wild at Heart and other projects, you know, used the symbolism Ooh. And the imagery from.
Okay.
If I take Judy as a Judy Garland here being... you know, basically the little girl on the yellow brick road that has the ruby slippers, right?
So who's off to see.
Who
the
basically
wizard.
Has, with one means or another, transferred and into another dimension, right? Is traveling mm-hmm. in another space of reality.
Okay.
And so there's that parallel that, you know, Judy could be the traveler between reality. And at the end of The Wizard of Oz, of course, she wakes up. She was unconscious or it was a dream world or
right.
whatever. But you have all these other characters like the woodsman and, you know.
So
something just
could
to mention,
think about,
possibly.
You know, is there anyone who is more of a parallel in these kind of more metaphoric terms
mm-hmm.
to Judy,
mm-hmm.
I mean, like as within The Wizard of Oz or something like that? Is
yeah.
there someone who would be on that kind of yellow brick road or something?
Yeah, and whereas I think that in the story, it's a young lady mm-hmm. and surrounded by other figures like a team, who Cowardly Lion and all of them, Tin Woodsman and all of them,
yeah.
who are trying to help her, and also they all have like some absence they need. But in my mind, if I'm to overlay that on top of the Twin Peaks story, I can't help but think that possibly Laura Palmer
yeah.
is, you know, Dorothy kind of thing.
Yeah, which of course, I mean, maybe this is getting too speculative.
Yeah.
Because we're right. The character's name is Dorothy, not Judy. Judy Garland is the actress who, okay. But mm-hmm. yeah, who's
but we,
Judy?
We like dipping little, maybe 1 foot like Jerry Horn into that rabbit hole and yeah, then back out again. Just, right?
Yeah, don't get lost there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, something to think about. Anyway, so at this Judy line, when he's saying, who is Judy over and over again, the phone rings and is almost a jump scare just because, you know, yeah. we listen to it loud as per yeah. David Lynch's direction.
Yeah, an old school phone ringing. And
yeah.
Mr. C's trying to ignore it at first, I thought, insisting, like, tell me who the fuck Judy is.
Yeah.
But then it seems like Jeffries starts kind of flickering out.
Yeah.
Right. And then he picks up the phone.
Yeah, he picks it up. You hear some interesting electrical sounds. He's projected outside to the phone booth outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then you hear that he's listening still. And like then you hear the sound of basically, I thought Jeffrey's hanging up on him and finally ending
yeah,
the transmission.
Yeah, there's kind of some static scratching and then mm-hmm. a dial tone. So.
Yeah. So transmission mm-hmm. over. I guess once you go up above the convenience store, your way out is through that phone booth.
I guess.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And could be, you know, it's reminds me of a couple of things. A little shot to Doctor Who or something even.
Yeah,
or
sure.
The Matrix even, like traveling mm-hmm. interdimensionally through a phone and mm-hmm. getting jacked in or what.
But then, yeah. oh shit, Richard's there.
He takes a few steps away from this booth, and then Richard Horn is not only there, but he's holding a gun on him.
Right, so apparently Richard followed him from the farm.
Yeah, we can see his little beater car in the background.
And Richard says, I know who you are, you're FBI, you know, my mother had a picture of you.
And he says, who is your mom?
And finally, here's the confirmation yes. everyone's been waiting for, that it's Audrey.
Yeah, and yeah. he says, and you're Cooper, I know that you're Cooper.
But, you know, one of the things here is that it doesn't really answer my questions.
Yeah.
Right? Like, okay, fine, his mother's Audrey.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
That's fine. It's the yeah, it's the very first step just, of getting
yeah,
an explanation.
It's the very first step. But my bigger yeah. question is still, like, who raised this kid?
Yeah.
How did this happen? What is his current relationship yeah. like to Audrey? And
who's the father? Which maybe,
who's the father?
Maybe through this part of the narrative is the question we're getting answered.
Right.
Because at this, he doesn't like getting called Cooper, and Mr. C is full of tricks, and he knows how to fight, right? But he's just like Dougie, too, actually.
Yeah.
But he does this maneuver where he spits to the ground almost like... you know, when you spit because you're disgusted by something.
Yeah.
And then, but that takes Richard Horn's attention away just yeah, enough just for him to, like, attack him and get the gun.
Grabs him and kicks the shit out of him briefly and yeah, then so says, you know, get in the truck. We'll talk about it down the way.
Yeah. First of all, don't ever threaten me again, you little ant. I'll step on you.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then get in the car and we'll talk about it. So it kind of is like, okay, so I kind of thought before when Richard Horn sees him in Montana
mm-hmm.
on the camera footage, watches him win the arm wrestling match and then kill somebody. He's been following him since then, and I kind of got the feeling back then that, okay, so what if Mr. C becomes Richard Horn's mentor or something?
Yeah, maybe we'll get a scene next week. Richard, I am your father.
Yeah, yeah, I could. Oh my
God, I hope
that's
not.
Honestly, that, but that might come out in some weird alternate way
yeah,
too, though.
Maybe.
So they leave the convenience store and drive off. The convenience store itself crackles
oh, God,
and fizzles
yeah.
and disappears into the woods.
Right, which makes me think, you know, wondering where this is. It makes me think that maybe it moves around or
yeah.
something, right?
Yeah.
Like,
good.
Because I originally thought back in part eight that we were in New Mexico.
Right.
But here, I don't think we're in New Mexico.
Yeah.
We might be in Montana still, mm-hmm. or we might be in Idaho or mm-hmm. something like that. But I don't think we're in New Mexico. I guess we could be. But,
well, another question is, which part of this sentient space is considered the Dutchman's, if any of it? Are we thinking mm-hmm. that this is the Dutchman's? And possibly...
I was thinking this is the Dutchman's. This yeah. is the connection I was making. Ray told Mr. C that last he knew, Jeffries was at the Dutchman's,
yeah.
but that's not a real place, right?
Right?
Mr. C shoots him in the head and says, I know what it is.
Yeah.
Which made me think, okay, he knows what the Dutchman's is. This is where Jeffries is, according to Ray. So that's where he went.
Mm-hmm.
That was the connection I was drawing.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
So the other thing in this scene is that as they're getting into the truck, Mr. C and Richard, Mr. C shoots out a quick text message that says, Las Vegas?
Yeah, question mark. Possibly we're wondering where this is going, but possibly to Diane?
Yeah, I mean, at first I kind of took this as confirmation, even though I don't want it to be, that it is in fact Mr. C who's been sending Diane text messages.
But he's also in contact with Hutch and Chantel, right? And
yeah, that got pointed out to me, and I did think, okay, well, he did send Chantel and Hutch to this doubleheader in Vegas, so he could have sent it to them.
Which we've just seen.
The further question or other question would be, if it were to Diane, right, if this is the text message that we saw Diane get a couple episodes ago,
yeah,
then how does this timeline fit together?
Yeah.
And my head started hurting as I tried to think about that.
Yeah.
Like, I suppose maybe it could be the text message, and then maybe that could be what we're seeing with Mr. C. Maybe could be on, like, September 30th. Because I'm thinking that Diane and the others went to the site with Bill Hastings on September 30th. Right, I don't know. Putting all this stuff together is really difficult. But that is... if we're going to hold out any hope for the possibility that Diane's texting with someone else, you can at least put this pressure on the idea that this is Mr. C texting her right then.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I don't know.
Hmm. So, but nevertheless, they drive away. The convenience store kind of crackles and dissipates and disappears.
Yeah. It sort of flickers and staticky, and we're back to the dark woods. And again, like, yeah. Where is this place?
Yeah. Does it exist in different spaces and comes to in different locations? Or is this like the vortex points that it has to be there? And once it's gone, you know, the next day people will drive down this road and they'll just see Richard's car abandoned and nothing else kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. It is also curious, right? Richard, well, I guess he doesn't have a choice. Mr. C just thoroughly beat his ass.
Yeah.
And his car sucks. So, okay. Yeah. It's fine that he abandons his
car. And he kind of is going down this path. He wants tutelage from Mr. C, or whatever you'd say. He wants...
I don't know that he knows that he wants that yet.
Yeah.
Because he's thinking, this is Cooper, the FBI agent, who I just saw at this big criminal hangout. That's no good. The FBI is on to the gang that I am affiliated with.
But at the same time, he knows he's not an undercover agent. He's just watched him murder two people. That's, you know...
I don't know.
He knows he's evil. He knows he's... He might have used to be FBI, but I get the feeling that Richard Horn knows he's evil... knows he's the head of this gang now, and has followed him because he's kind of going,
maybe,
you know, up this scale of becoming more and more of an evil figure.
Mm-hmm.
And where will this all lead? Will these two come in contact with Red? Will Richard come across Red again with Mr. C?
Kind of been waiting to see Red again.
Yeah. What's that showdown going to be like?
Of a character, you know, and we've only seen him a couple of times, you know. But that scene where he does the magic trick with the dime.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's cool. This guy's cool.
Yeah, I kind of feel that Mr. C's response to that would be like, what are you, in nursery school? You know? It would be the same. Like, oh, you're just playing tricks, but I'm here for business, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, great, amazing scene. I love these scenes with the convenience store and the woodsman. And this one gave us a ton of new information that we're, you know, constantly wondering about.
And we basically go from dark woods to the woods in the daytime.
Yeah, this beautiful transition shot, like the drone shots over the trees. It comes over at one particular big tree and shows a waterfall.
Yeah.
You get the beautiful natural beauty of the water running through the woods.
And we see Cyril Pons walking his dog.
Yeah.
This is Mark Frost.
This is Mark Frost. Is this really his? Is it a little Boston Terrier or something? Is that his dog?
Oh, I didn't look.
Do we know?
That.
Does anybody know whose dog that is? But it's great to see the writer of the show as a character walking his dog. Mm. And of course, as is David Lynch in this. So both creators of the show have placed themselves as the dreamer living in the dream kind of thing.
And if anyone doesn't remember, we did see Cyril Pons back in the original series as a newscaster reporting on the mill fire and so on.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we see him, and then we sort of pan over to Gersten and Steven.
Yeah, we go a little further into the woods ahead of Cyril, and we see Steven and Gersten Hayward. Steven looks like he's high or something. He's rubbing his leg. He's got a handgun.
Yeah.
And we start the conversation. Gersten says, why?
He says, there is no why.
And he says, I did do it.
Right. So, okay. First big question.
Yeah.
What is he talking about?
What is he talking about? What did he do? But
she
Gersten's
says,
response
no,
is,
she
yeah.
she did it.
No, she did it. And he says, you know, I can't. No, I did it.
Still, what is it?
Yeah. And she's still saying, no, Steven, you didn't do anything. You were just stoned.
Right.
And what the fuck did she give you? And
so is she implying that Steven only did what he did because of some she gave him drugs?
That's what it kind of sounds like. Yeah.
Maybe.
And she's trying to get the gun out of his hands because she says, give me the gun then. And he says, mm-mm, no.
And she keeps kissing his head and stuff like that.
But here's where there's this really weird interaction that starts, and you don't know if he's speaking metaphorically or what exactly he's speaking of, but it gets a little scary. He says, "Are you going to come up there with me?"
Yeah.
And she says, "No, you're not going either." And he says, "Look at me. I'm a high school graduate," and repeats, "I'm a high school graduate."
Right. And as he's loading the gun, he's like, "I've got to get this in there." There's a point where he kind of points at his temple, and it's already being telegraphed that he's talking about suicide.
Yeah. He says, "You know, you see this here? I'm going to get this thing in," talking about the bullet in the clip. She says, "Wait, no, don't, no, no." And he says, "And when I see you come up, but I may not even see you there. I mean, gone."
Yeah.
You know, he's tripping over his words a little bit, but then he says, "Will I be with the rhinoceros, or will I be completely like turquoise?"
Yeah, all of this stuff. And then, you know, the other big thing I wanted to call attention to is he ultimately says, "I got a duty to do."
Yeah.
"You can do whatever you want."
Well, he says, "I feel something," and he says, "Fuck," and he says, "This is the end." Like, suddenly, something's coming on, whether it's this weird drug or some interaction with a zone type of space or something.
So, my two big questions, though, are, what is it that he did or whatever?
Yeah.
And on this phrase, "I have a duty to do."
Yeah.
A duty?
A duty. To kill himself, like seppuku? Yeah. Like, yeah. In a sense of, like, honor, like one would in a samurai film or something? Or is this more about like a duty because somebody else has a command over him and he's been ordered to do something?
Or does he somehow think that by killing himself, he'll be transported to some other dimension where he has something to do?
Yeah, possibly.
And is this the effect of that sparkle drug that's been going around?
Maybe the drug itself is causing people to do that crossover maneuver without a vortex or something.
That's what I was going
to
say. If it is the effect of that drug, does that drug really maybe do shit like that?
It's like the Jade Ring ground up into a drug-esque kind of format.
Yeah, I don't know. But Cyril Pons wanders in there. Gerson gets scared and runs around the tree, which I thought was a little weird.
Well, she's freaked out, and I kind of got the feeling that either she's high too, or they're both in a severe moment of emotional distress. And Cyril Pons is also scared by this and kind of runs away.
Yeah.
He's not expecting that.
So maybe Gersten doesn't want him to see her with Steven. That would make sense because Steven's cheating on Becky. Still.
Also, it depends on what he did that they might be talking about. And I'm trying to insert things. There's tons of guesses and speculation. When was the last time we saw Becky? Has something happened to Becky?
Did Steven
kill
Becky?
Did Steven kill Becky? We did see, and that would make sense with like a jealous lover also saying, "No, it's her fault. She's the one that led to this event." You know. We also did see Becky shooting bullets into Gersten's apartment. Mm-hmm. We know about that. And we also, in this moment, can think back to when Steven and Becky were fighting in their trailer. There is a moment where Steven kind of says to something along the lines of, "I know what you did."
Yeah, I believe he says that to her.
To her.
He's like drooling and slobbering and intimidating her and being a domestic abuser.
Right. So what did she do in that moment? And now it's back to what did he do? And Gersten saying, "No, you didn't do it. She didn't. Yeah. She did it."
And we saw Becky calling Shelley a couple episodes ago saying Steven's been missing for 2 days. How does that fit in here? We don't quite know.
Because, again, the timeline doesn't lead us to think that it's specifically linear with that.
Regardless, we hear a gunshot, and we don't see.
Well, something significant, I think, to point out leading up to this, too, when he's saying, you know, will I be with a rhinoceros or lightning in a bottle, or will I be, like, completely turquoise, describing that? He says, "I feel something, fuck, this is the end." After he says, "I got a duty," he does have this kind of moment that's a sexualized moment. He says to her, "Do whatever you want," but he points out, he says, "I liked fucking you, did I tell you? I like to get down and fight and fuck."
Yeah.
So something where,
gross, so.
Yeah. Well, but it's something pointing out that in their relationship that there's, that is associated,
right,
that they have the sexual relationship that involves this kind
also,
of abuse and this kind of fighting.
Turn from him saying, you know, "I like your cunt," to calling her a cunt.
Exactly what I wanted to point out. Yeah. She starts crying and he says, "Just so you know, I like your cunt." But then he turns that on her and then calls her, objectifying her.
Yeah. He's like, "You're making me cry, cunt."
Yeah. And then that's actually right before Cyril Pons interrupts, right?
Right.
So she's in this moment of distress. She's crying. Whatever has just happened, I get the sense that they're super high and there's this element of guilt somehow.
Yeah.
And she tries to hide her face from it around the other side of the tree, during which
it
seems like Steven
and
kills
it
himself.
Feels like that's what happened. We don't see it, but it seems like
So then, she freaks out. She's a great actress, I think, and is really did an amazing job in that moment.
Her freaking out by the tree.
Yeah. That was like, how would you process that? But then she's kind of looking up into the trees, and we hear some whooshing. And it's a similar pose, I thought, to when you see Becky in the car, also high with Steven, kind of looking up into the sky, the kind of the angle of the camera on the face and the eyes. We see that mimicked here with Gersten looking up to the treetop.
Or maybe it's even a kind of reversal, right? Because Becky's looking up, you know, ecstatically joyful.
And right.
Gersten's looking up, you know, terribly broken and afraid and sad or something, right?
And maybe
it's kind of mirror image.
When I saw the first go round of Becky kind of looking up in the car, that reminded me of Laura Palmer, like a young, beautiful Laura Palmer in a moment, like looking up, whether looking up to the angel or looking up as she's tied up in the train. But
I mean, that was a beautiful scene. I have to admit, there was one evening where I just watched that scene probably like 10 times in a row.
Yeah.
Just of Becky looking up in the sky. Because it really was great. So
gorgeous. The music and like the idea of freedom and the air moving, and it is beautiful. But here's, like you say, could be the opposite of that. And I did get the feeling like there was a little ghostly feeling to the trees themselves, because you kind of hear the sound of the trees. It's the whooshing and it's the wind, but it made it, to me, it felt like the trees all have ghosts within them or something.
Yeah.
And also we've seen a couple other scenes before where someone has died, whether it's Lucy looking up after being told Margaret Lanterman's dead while she's touching the wood, or whether it's Carl Rod looking up above the body of the young boy that's killed at the intersection by Richard Horn.
Right.
But we've seen a couple times where somebody has just died, and then there's another observer of that death who kind of ends up looking up toward the sky, up above the area where the body was dead. And in Carl Rod's case, we see that he does see something of like a spiritual kind of entity.
Mm-hmm.
But something just interesting to note.
Yeah, and so then we go to the Fat Trout Trailer Park, where apparently Cyril Pons lives.
Yeah.
And
we saw him before, Carl. Where Carl Rod kind of waves at him once before.
Okay.
And now he's actually got an interaction with him and actually tells him what he saw. And we hear him say, you know,
this
from...
That trailer.
That trailer is where he lives. Becky's and then he showed the broken glass there, and we're reminded of the mug that gets thrown out of that.
Yeah, so I don't know if he's still a newscaster or what. According to Mark Forrest on Twitter, it's a long story.
It's a long story.
Yeah.
Right, meaning, you know, something came up where you shared that, right? And he responded?
Yeah, I got a response on Twitter from Mark Forrest. We did.
Yeah,
on
why
our
is Cyril Pons
podcast Twitter
in a trailer park, because he used to be in the original series of broadcaster.
Yeah, he retweeted it and said it's a long story.
Oh, funny.
I thought that was really cool, and that, you know, I wonder, Mark Frost probably has that story.
Yeah,
in his head
and
somewhere.
We're sitting here thinking, gosh, Mark Frost, we sure would love to hear that story sometime.
Indeed.
So it cuts from here, and we go to the roadhouse. And when we see the roadhouse this time, I kind of got that feeling like we did from episode 8 that, oh, wait, are we seeing this a little bit too early? What is this the setup for?
Oh, yeah, but I love this so much.
This is so cool. Again, break the expectation of what we're thinking we're going to get.
First of all, let's go slow, because there's so much greatness in, like, 30 seconds.
Yeah, that's true.
First of all, the MC introducing what amounts to a song from the jukebox.
Yes.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen,
the Roadhouse is proud to present
one of our favorite
playlist songs. You know, maybe it's an iPad or whatever at this point, right?
But there's like a stereo with a cardboard like meter built onto the volume knob. Then when you turn it up, it goes into the red.
It's up to 11.
Yeah, exactly. And, it's in the red zone now.
Right, you're pointing out, right, that it actually looks like there are wires underneath it. Like, maybe this actually controls the volume.
Yeah, I think it is actually a lead-through that is the volume that when you turn it up. Yeah.
And then the song is ZZ Top.
Sharp Dress Man. This is really great. And it's really grooving, and somehow it just fits so perfectly. But it's so out of place to play a song like
this. Well, and it's funny, because the last time we got a song that was out of place was Viva Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And in the midst of, you know, thinking about that episode, I did end up watching ZZ Top's performance of Viva Las Vegas.
Oh, interesting.
I was like, this is the best one. Yeah. So, I don't know. That's me. But that kind of connection coming in my own mind here is a cool little moment.
Yeah.
The song starts, and then the MC dancing.
Yeah. MC dancing.
Awesome.
And also the MC with the microphone that has the pine cone on the end of this wireless mic.
So
the wireless mic, that's when you're speaking to a wireless mic, the end of the piece that's there is the transmitter, and that goes over to a receiver somewhere in the room.
Yeah.
But he's got a pine cone right on the transmitter, so he's transmitting through a pine cone.
And that's been
pretty
interesting. Before, I believe.
Yeah, he's had it every time.
I don't know if it's always there.
I think every time I've seen the full mic, I think I see it, yeah.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was an interesting touch.
This is so great.
Yeah.
Not
to mention that thinking about ZZ Top... From David Lynch's perspective, I see in ZZ Top a little bit of a doppelganger thing going on in the band, right?
Right, because they all have the big long beards. Yeah. You can hardly tell them apart.
They're like all versions of each other. Yeah. And somehow, I don't know, maybe just worth mentioning. But also sharp-dressed man, and I'm dressing up, I'm going to look good, but I don't know where and I'm going tonight, you know.
There's a mention of new shoes in here. Which yeah. I was just like, all right, Leo Johnson, yeah. shout out.
Okay.
New yeah. shoes.
New shoes. Yeah, in the tone. But then okay. we see James, right? So James actually is there with Freddie.
Yep, they come in and they see Renee in the bar. Don't know if this is the same night as when they were at the Great Northern or what.
Right.
But they kind of walk over and James tries to say hi to Renee. It's really awkward.
Yeah.
Actually.
And they're a little too far away to be friendly, like, oh, hey, just pass through, say what's up to y'all. You know, it's like, he's kind of like looking at her first.
And he doesn't get her eye contact.
Yeah.
Right, which is, that's what you do, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
You try to like get the eye contact from the person and then you say, hi.
Yeah.
But he's just at a bit of a distance, you know.
Yeah, he's like watching her from a distance and says, good to see you, Renee. And you're like, what? Did she even hear you say that, dude?
Yeah, she's talking to
are you talking to yourself or are you talking to her? Yeah.
But don't forget, James has always been cool.
Yeah.
Renee's husband, who we find out is Chuck.
She's screaming Chuck, yeah.
Presumably the same Chuck.
I don't know if it's the same Chuck, but it would make a lot of sense, right? We heard from Charlie saying that Chuck had his truck stolen, right?
Right, and Audrey said that she thought Chuck had a screw loose or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels like the same Chuck to me, though. Let's come back around to the truck thing in a minute, mm-hmm. maybe. Because Renee's husband, Chuck, stands up and, you know, he's taking issue with James saying hi to his wife. So, you know, you don't talk to my wife ever, right?
Yeah, and James is trying to kind of like not defend himself, but trying to explain. And he stutters a little bit and he's kind of like weak in this moment. But he's trying to say, I was just trying to be polite. I like her, so I was going to be polite. But by the time he gets I like her out, Chuck is already like on him and pummeling him.
And I do wonder about what the backstory is here.
Yeah.
Right. That being said, Chuck definitely seems like an asshole.
Yeah.
And
his buddy jumps up and starts kicking James, too. So there's two on one in this moment. They're getting beat up. And, of course, we're all thinking about Freddy.
Yeah, Freddy. He's got his magic green
garden
glove.
And Freddy says, you know, oi, you better stop this.
Right? Yeah, and, of course, they pay him no mind because he just seems like a wimpy little shit.
Well, also, I dug that Chuck's friend is like, fuck you, punk. And yeah. I don't know to call out the punk movement and punk from England or whatever.
Right.
But he is from, you know, East End London
yeah,
town.
Yeah, that's true.
And he calls him punk. And then you get two punches from this glove, right?
Well, I love the effect with the punches.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what the sound was exactly.
I took it as a mixture of sounds, conglomeration. But definitely, I feel like there's a lightning bolt thunder in there. When, you know, when lightning sounds like a gunshot. That's what I thought the sample was.
It just struck me as just on the right side of almost being comic booky.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was just a smidge away from being like, boy, yo, 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 yo,
yeah. And where you see the word pow,
like,
bang.
Slam.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and also this is like a superhero kind of thing.
Yeah.
And previous episode, we've just been described what this glove is all about. And we are asked to believe that he has superhuman strength
but
in his one hand.
The most significant thing about the effect, I thought, was the fact that the music cuts out.
So the music cuts out, and it's kind of an interruption in maybe the electrical. Mm-hmm. Nature of the electricity running in the room.
Mm-hmm.
We do hear it like a lightning bolt, lightning being, you know, the strongest amount of electricity. And
yeah.
So, yeah, I felt like there was some electro-charged thing happening when he punches them.
Mm-hmm.
These guys hit the floor, and they go into, like, weird seizure. Yeah. Your
These
brain is jelly.
These guys are not
you know?
Okay.
Yeah, and James calls it out, knowing the story that he just heard from
James
Freddy.
James says, you know, his eyes don't look right. But it also seems almost like, I don't know, something coming out of Chuck's mouth or something. Makes it seem like more than just the effects of a really strong punch.
Yeah, this is like, leading over into, you know, almost what the drunk in the jail cell is experiencing or something like that even.
Yeah, worse.
Yeah.
I mean, so this, I think, pretty much led us to conclude the answer is, yes, Freddy did murder a guy in England and then flee
Yeah,
the
he
country.
Probably did break his Gregory and then flee the country for the West Coast.
Because, like, well, the other bit of information here being that Freddy tells James that he tried to hold himself back.
Yeah,
right?
He says, like, I tried not to hit him too hard, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Wasn't a full
and
strength.
And in the shot, the way that they do it, punch. Yeah, he barely extends his arm, and it's like, boop, you know?
Yeah.
I tried not to hit him too hard, and James actually apologizes, calls for an ambulance, tells everybody, these guys are seriously hurt, if you don't know. Calls for the ambulance, says his eyes don't look right, and then he also kind of tries to apologize and tells Renee, you know, look, I did not mean for this to happen.
Right.
And I kind of got the idea that Renee responded saying, you know, oh my God, you're she, I don't know, I'm on the line with this where she's kind of like, you know, because she's yelling at Chuck, telling Chuck, don't hurt James.
Right.
We don't know what their history is. Where is this going to lead? You know, and is it, and because, you know, James and Freddie are taken to jail, it really is like they walked into a bar, picked a fight with a guy over his wife and like beat the shit out of the guy.
Right.
You know?
And again,
but it's James and Freddie and, you know.
Yeah. And what's the backstory? Because we did also see Renee crying as James saying, just you and I a couple episodes ago. So.
Yeah.
Regardless. Mm-hmm. I love seeing the glove in action. I didn't think we were going to get it so quick.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I did like that, where it's like, here's the setup, guys. Next episode, boom, here's the delivery. You know, I really loved how that flowed together from one to the other.
Yeah, so from here we go to Vegas.
Yep.
And more humor.
Yes.
Right? So I love the humor. The Vegas FBI and our friends, Agent Headley and Wilson.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so Wilson has basically told Agent Headley, like, I've got a Douglas and Jane in the other room waiting with their kids. They're okay, but the kids don't seem so happy.
Kids?
Kids.
Wilson!
Yeah, and he screaming Wilson like this, which I took as a play on Dennis the Menace, because a couple things. Yeah. Wilson does have, like, the kind of platinum blonde sleek hair with a part on the side.
Right,
And then the FBI agent says, Wilson! But it's kind of a reversal instead of Wilson screaming, Dennis!
Yeah, you know? I definitely felt that vibe as well.
But yeah, kids. It's just hilarious. And
I don't know if, like... I don't know that they should know that Dougie and Janie E only have the one kid.
Right.
But regardless, I thought Headley was upset that you brought in a bunch of kids.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah.
And you hear the kid crying and so on and so forth.
Yeah, when they actually show the family for a second, a couple of things struck me as strange about them. First of all, you can kind of see who's the mother father figure, but there's like maybe a sister, an aunt, or possibly a caretaker woman that's there that's much older than the kids and is an adult age as the father and mother are, too. So we don't know. Maybe that was the aunt or something. But
you notice the one girl.
There's one little girl that has, like, red hair. And, yeah, she's wearing bunny slippers. Mm-hmm. So bunny imagery, again, like we've seen in Sarah Palmer's Home.
It's all about the bunnies.
It's all about the bunnies, Jack Rabbit's Palace and all. But this little redheaded girl is standing there with her eyes shut in a meditative pose, like chanting almost. Mm. And she's got her hands posed in a triangle, like doing her own little mantra or something. And so I thought that was kind of strange.
Yeah.
And then the youngest kid is just the whole time, just one long tone of a scream. It's like the highest pitched scream a human can do. Mm-hmm. And only a child can do, basically. And then so at seeing that, Agent Headley slams the door and is like, you know, oh my God, this is not the Dougie and Janie E we're looking for.
Yeah,
basically.
It's pretty clear. And I love the kind of, are they as incompetent as the detectives Fusco? Maybe not quite, but they're just slightly better or something, right? And so having, you know, I know people last week were saying like, oh, they can't mess around with this, you know, like they can't throw the fingerprints in the trash like the Fuscos did. They need to get to it, right?
Yeah.
Things got to happen. Run out of episodes.
Yeah.
You know? And so we just get this quick little part and I thought it was quite funny. But it's not delaying anything. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, Lynch and Frost have this planned out. We're just getting this little shot here. And
right.
I'm entirely confident things are going to come together in, you know, part 16.
Yeah, the timing so far has been so perfect. Yeah, we're right on par.
Yeah.
So we stay in Vegas. From this, we go to Duncan Todd's office, actually.
Yeah. Roger, can you come in here, please?
Yeah.
Which I feel like is how every scene with him begins.
It's true.
I realize.
Yeah. And Roger's like, gosh.
Or ends. So.
But he asks, you know, did you find Anthony yet?
Right, and he says no, and he says, we'll find him, and then this gets interrupted by Duncan Todd getting shot in the head.
Yeah, so this is Chantel coming in. She's like sees him, shoots him in the head. There's this amazing CGI that's pretty gross that happens.
Yeah, I loved it. And I basically knew it was her right away, but you don't see her face for a bit. You see her from behind.
Yeah.
So you would have to kind of remember that Chantel and Hutch were supposed to do this doubleheader in Vegas.
Yeah. And, of course, she's on her way out, and you would not have seen her face except for she does return because she hears the wheezing of Roger.
God, poor Roger got caught up in this, you know? And, she has to go back because the first shot didn't kill him. So she's on the phone with Hutch already. He's like, oh, hold on, honey.
And she says,
you don't see it. He's like, all right.
One down, one to go.
And French fries.
Extra ketchup. So with Chantel and Hutch, this is really great. Their main two things is murder and snacks, basically.
Yeah,
fast food and killing.
Eating, like junk food.
Yeah.
Cheetos, Wendy's.
Yeah, Hutch and Chantel are basically like the metaphor for heart disease, maybe.
Yeah, but also she says one down, one to go.
Yeah.
Right. So
this is the doubleheader, and one of them is down.
Roger was not a part of the doubleheader.
Right.
Duncan was, but not Roger.
Right.
He was just there.
You're thinking it's probably Dougie then is going to be the second part of that doubleheader, or?
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
That would make sense.
Mm-hmm. You have any other guesses for that?
You know, I mean, the other guesses don't fit quite as well, like Ike the Spike.
Yeah, the Mitchum, one of the Mitchums.
Like thinking about other people who failed to kill Dougie.
I see.
But it would make more sense to me. Duncan Todd was sort of point man tasked with carrying this out. He's failed, kill him, and do the original job, kill Dougie.
Yeah.
Probably makes the most sense. Yeah.
That would make sense. As you say, though, possibly the idea that it could be Ike the Spike, it's fun to picture Chantel and Hutch facing off against Ike, right?
Yeah.
That would have to be a really extreme scene.
The thing is, he got arrested and so on. And
right.
I think he's just kind of off the board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but Hutch has quite easily killed a warden.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, sure, yeah, okay, I'll kill a warden.
It's not impossible, but also, yeah. You know, even if you were Mr. C, you could probably say, like, well, he's in prison or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
I just love the idea of it. You know,
how
extreme would that whole battle be? We would get to see Ike with like a newly fashioned fresh spike, you know, since his last one was busted up.
Or I also like the idea of the three of them just having a drink.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. They're in the same trade. They might as well like associate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we picture that they're off to Wendy's or wherever to get their fries. The next shot we get is an external night shot establishing that we're back at Twin Peaks Sheriff Department.
Right.
We cut into the jail cell with the drunk.
Yeah, and they're bringing in James and Freddie because of the incident at the roadhouse.
Yeah, they've been arrested for this fight or, you know, attack, whatever they ended up calling it.
And we see this drunk again. I think the first thing he repeats is the line to put him in eight.
Yeah, Hawk says, right. Put him in number eight, put him in eight. And the drunk repeats, put him in eight.
But, you know, as I was saying to you, no one is acknowledging this guy except for Chad.
Yeah, so far we've only seen Chad talk to the drunk.
I'm really starting to wonder if he's a figment of Chad's mind or something. I don't know. I mean, you would think, particularly because his face is all fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
Would the Twin Peaks cops that we know and love leave a guy just sitting in jail who maybe needs to go to the hospital?
Yeah, without acknowledging it at all.
Don't acknowledge it at all. Don't acknowledge him at all. This definitely feels really weird, and I'm definitely starting to wonder if maybe he's not quite real or something. Yeah.
So one person that Chad does acknowledge, though, is Freddie, right? He says something along the lines of, what did that glove freak do now?
What did he do now? So I guess probably Chad has, maybe arrested Freddie for something in the past.
Yeah, or at least come to some trouble over the glove, or he at least knows part of the story, and he knows that maybe he's just calling him a freak because he always wears the glove and he doesn't know the story.
Yeah, actually. That's true. It is Chad.
It is Chad.
So maybe Chad's just seen this guy and he's thought, like, I know it's a free country, but why are you wearing that glove,
yeah,
freak?
Exactly. But at this, Hawk says, shut up, Chad. And then the drunk hilariously repeats,
shut up, Chad.
And it's really got me laughing that moment. Like, shut up, Chad. You know. And then, of course, James, being cool, says, you know, well, are those two guys okay? He's actually worried about the guys.
Hawk tells him they're in intensive care.
Intensive care. And the drunk repeats that. They're in intensive care. At this moment, kind of James and the others kind of notice Naido is sitting there.
Yeah, I think James notices. He's like, what the hell?
Yeah, and she's kind of like reaching and feeling the air before she starts making these kind of monkey animal sounds again.
Mm-hmm.
And she does her little whimpering and chanting. The drunk kind of repeats the chanting or has his own version, whatever's going on there.
Yeah, so I think this is the same night as in part 14.
Yeah, that would make sense. Chad screams, shut up, and the drunk repeats that, and you see that Chad has been in this cell just getting tortured, basically.
Yeah, all these noises. He can't escape. Yeah.
But now it's interesting to see that Freddie and James have been added to the party. You just kind of picture this jail cell is where some shit is going to blow up.
Well, and I wonder if we're going to buy into Freddie's claims about his destiny.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he's right where he's supposed to be.
Yeah, maybe he's already carried out his destiny in that moment.
Or maybe protecting Naido is his destiny.
Yeah. Interesting.
Something like that.
Yeah, but it's all coming together. All roads lead here.
He might be able to punch himself out of that jail if he wanted
to. So.
It seems like.
Right.
Very
interesting. But also Freddie, we know, kind of coming to the States following his destiny. just like when he's talking about like, oh, a big box of cardboard boxes, I'll just jump into it, you know, for fun. Mm-hmm. You know, he's kind of like he's willing to go where the universe leads him, right? Yeah, and so I can picture him like sitting in the jail cell like, all right, you know, I'll do my job here.
Yeah.
You know, it's not as more than my job's worth or whatever.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So we do cut from this then, right?
Go back to Chantel and Hutch.
Back to Hutch and Chantel. And they're, of course,
eating their burgers.
Eating food.
And fries.
Yeah. And rationalizing murder.
Might as well call us a un-Christian nation.
Yeah, government does it. They all kill. Yeah. Maybe you should say, thou shalt kill.
Forgive no one. Fuck them in the ass. Yeah,
fuck them in the ass. This is money like Curly or something. Is yeah.
Like, there's like... There is something of a point they're making here, right?
Yeah, he says kill damn near all the Indians.
Yeah,
you know?
And that, okay, yeah, we're killers, but shit, government's killers.
Yeah, it's a nation of killing. There's they so just, much killing in our
you know,
history.
They think their killing's legal.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And suggesting the morality of it.
But in the middle of this, Chantel definitely points out that her fun is over once the person is dead because she loves torture.
Yeah, that's so right. She's like, I haven't got to torture anyone in a fuck of a while or something.
Yeah, she's just like, ah, it's fucked. You ever known anybody that said, oh, it's so fucked I haven't been able to torture somebody in a while?
It just hasn't worked out, baby.
And then she says, you know, did you get me a dessert? And he's like, you know,
no,
I did. Yeah. Hilarious.
I love these guys.
Yeah, they've intertwined this, you know, violence with their snack time.
And they love each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he says, I love you, Hutch. He says, you know, I love you, Chantel. And she says, or Hutch says, it's a beautiful night.
And then, the shot. At first I laughed because I was like, that's not what I would call it.
Yeah, it's night, all right. But yeah, when you look out the window, you see the power lines. And like, what you think is a single star, right in the middle of all the power lines, right?
But Chantel says Mars.
No, that's Mars. And it's one of these moments we've all seen where it's like, oh no, because the city and the light pollution, we can't see the stars. But you know what? There's a planet. Mm. And she knows what planet. And it's Mars. And it's Mars, the god of war.
Yeah.
And they, you know, are killers sitting here enjoying their hamburgers. So. Yeah. I just thought that was really great. It's a funny moment, but her pointing out the planet.
Yeah, I wonder if Chantel also has a passing interest in astrology.
Yeah.
It would fit for
me.
Totally. Like, I could just totally see that for her.
Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
So, yeah.
Astrology and torture. You know, Jesus. Two things that really rub me the right way. This episode, right about this point of this episode, I started thinking, man, we're hitting everything up here. Wow, where are we going to go next? Yeah. And boom, we get the red door of Dougie's house.
Yay.
And that's cool because we get back to Dougie
and
Janie E, and he gets a piece of chocolate cake. Janie says something like, is it delicious?
Yeah, delicious.
And he repeats, but he says it kind of pronouncing it the same way she does, delicious.
And,
and
she's kind of kneeling by him, like kind of fawning over him.
Yeah.
You know, all of our dreams are coming true.
And he repeats true.
Yeah.
You know, and then she goes in to presumably finish cleaning up from dinner or whatever.
Yeah. But then I kind of enjoyed watching Kyle MacLachlan eat cake.
Yeah.
I have to say, I don't know.
This is a great scene. I love that they're taking the time with this. There's a couple things that happen. The first action that he does, he's kind of fidgeting with stuff on the table.
Mm-hmm.
There's like some weird shaped salt and pepper shakers. He separates them like they don't belong together.
And you pointed out to me, I think, the resemblance between those and the shape of the bells and such we've seen.
Yeah, they're very similar to the bells in the Giant's Presence or on the Eraserhead Space Station.
Or White Lodge, maybe it is.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
But he separates them, and it was kind of like, oh, they don't go together, but it's also like salt and pepper, and that's also like this dichotomy, you know, right? Like, you know, good, evil, or something. I don't know. There's the Twin Peaks and the two twins, though, of an object. Oh, there's two of them. They're exactly the same. They're standing next to each other.
Yeah.
You know, let me separate them.
Okay. And then he starts sort of poking at the remote.
Yeah. And he's, I don't know, maybe Janie has shown him this, watched, he's already into TV.
Well, I was thinking as this was going, like, oh, we're kind of seeing, you know, Dougie explore the world.
Right.
Like, hey, what's this thingamawatsit?
Yeah.
Doop, doop.
Takes him like three times hitting it, and he's pushing on it randomly in between these bites of his chocolate cake.
Yeah. And he finally hits like the power button, and it turns on the TV.
And we see
Sunset Boulevard. It's a bit from Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. Which is, first of all, where Gordon Cole's name comes from. The first character we see is Norma Desmond, which reminds us of Norma and Agent Chet Desmond.
And this movie is clearly an influence on Lynch. I mean, he said so.
Yeah, he said so.
It's a film worth watching.
Yeah,
you know,
of course. It's amazing. And on screen, we see Cecil B. DeMille standing there.
And I even thought that the sort of failed storyline in season two of Twin Peaks with James and all of that was like trying to play with Sunset Boulevard themes.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work.
Yeah. But here he is, instead of going through that again, he's just showing part a clip from Sunset Boulevard.
Bit of the movie.
Yeah. And of course, on screen is Cecil B. DeMille, another great director. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen in these interviews, like Lynch talking about other directors and other work coming through, you know, we've talked about the Kubrick references and the Tati references. And here's kind of another shout out to another director that we're seeing on screen. Mm-hmm. But it's particularly interwoven into the story of Twin Peaks because of the names. And we see Dougie hear the name, and not only hear the name, but hears "Get me Gordon Cole," right? Get Gordon Cole.
Right. And there's also one of the other lines is something about getting the team together.
Getting the team back together.
Maybe that's some kind
and
of
And he perks up his eyes and he sits up a little straighter and...
See, but I thought when he heard Gordon Cole that he seemed kind of terrified almost or something.
I read it as like one of those like, oh, my God, kind of moments.
Yeah, like maybe. I'm not sure how to read
an epiphany
exactly.
Or a new discovery happening.
And how do you read him then, you know?
A little shocking.
Hitting the remote. Like, is he trying to make it stop or what?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, that's a good question. I was thinking he was like trying to pause it or rewind it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the remote, like a chocolate cake and a fork or another simple contraptions that he has gotten used to using or something. But either way, it does end up paused on that face.
Right.
And as the sound goes out from the movie, it's paused on the face. He tunes into the sound of the electrical humming.
Mm-hmm.
And then his focus shifts down to the outlet.
And he gets down on the ground and starts crawling towards it with the fork.
It's calling him. He taps it like, oh, the fork. It kind of makes sense. And of course, this is one of those moments where like, to kids, right? This is a threat. Like, oh, don't let your kids stick a fork in the outlet.
Right.
Because...
Just like there's the eclipse today. It's a thing like, don't look directly into the sun.
Yeah.
It's like almost cliche. Like, don't stick a fork in the outlet.
Exactly.
Right?
It looks sort of like it would fit, but there's, you know, it'll kill you. But he does, and it won't fit because it's front of the fork, but there's this tense moment.
Around.
And he's flipping, and it flips slowly, and it's the tension building. This also reminded me of the moment in Dumbland, actually. There's one of David Lynch's cartoon Dumbland. There's a moment where the guy is playing with a lamp that has a broken bulb, and he's like over and over like getting closer and closer to touching it until he electrocutes himself.
Yeah.
But this is, we see Dougie stick the handle end of the fork into the socket. He basically electrocutes himself. We see him taking it like, and we cut over to the kitchen. We see Janie, the lights are flashing on and off. There's a shortage in the electrical system.
He shorts the circuit, apparently, by doing that.
And Janie E is screaming, terrified.
Like you do.
And we hear Sonny Jim calling down, like, what's going on kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut. It ends the scene. So we feel like we've seen right up to getting Cooper back.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know. We still don't know yet.
Yeah,
is that that
know.
Moment?
And yeah, I mean, okay. Maybe we would have liked to have gone a little bit further. But it was also just a really weird scene because as he's approaching the electrical socket, you know, part of me was worried that maybe Janie was going to come in and stop him.
Yeah.
You know, that's a weird thing to be thinking. Like, no, I want our hero to put a fork in the socket.
Yeah, it's true. It's like, that's interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, because is this going to hurt our beloved Dougie or is this going to help our beloved Cooper? Right.
Yeah. And we don't know what's going to happen, but it does seem like that's what we're playing with. Although, as I said to you last night, you know, if this is the impetus for Cooper snapping too, which of course everyone wants to see, I am going to be disappointed to not see Albert and Dougie.
Yeah, that's fine.
Interact.
I would love to see Albert and Dougie.
I was kind of looking forward to that.
Yeah.
So, oh well.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Still not ruled out, I guess.
So again, as I mentioned a little earlier on in the podcast, this is an episode of ups and downs, of tears of different sorts, some tears of joy at the possibility of getting Cooper back, and to see Ed and Norma getting back together pulls on my heartstrings incredibly.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this other great moment that leads us into this next scene where we go and we see the log lady's cabin with a light on in the window, and she's calling Hawk.
She's calling Hawk, and I think the first thing she said is, "Hawk, I'm dying." Right.
She says, "Hawk, I'm dying." Yep. And Hawk says, "I'm sorry, Margaret."
Yeah.
She goes to say, "Well, you know about death. It's just a change and it's not the end."
But there's some fear in letting go.
Yeah. She says, "Hawk, it's time." Before she says that, then there's some fear in letting go.
Right.
Remember what I told you? I can't say more over the phone. You know what I mean from our talks when we were able to speak face to face, she says.
Right. So why can't she say it over the phone? That's one question to kind of, you know, put a pin in here.
And she says, "Watch for the one I told you about, the one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain."
And so who is this one she is referring to is the other big question I thought emerging from this. So
And she says, yeah, who is that? It goes into her saying, Hawk, my log is turning gold.
Yeah.
The wind is moaning. Weird. I'm dying. Good night, Hawk.
And he says, good night, Margaret.
And then and the two of them hang up.
And he says, goodbye, Margaret.
And then he says, goodbye, Margaret. So yeah. This is the death of the log lady. And it's really
sad.
The log lady is, you know, right at the foundation, the spine of Twin Peaks and everything that
right.
we've gone through.
And I thought it was really, really cool, ultimately, that in the credits, the episode was dedicated to the memory of Margaret
Lanterman. Yeah.
Right, the character.
Right.
Of course, part one was dedicated to Catherine Coulson.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we were just talking when we did our brief little thing yesterday about that kind of thing, you know, the kind of life of these characters, mm-hmm. as kind of apart from the mind or whatever.
Yeah, right? If you
or,
give them their own sentience.
Yeah, yeah. That that they have their own kind of being in some sense, or how Lynch would say the world of Twin Peaks was always there, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
It actually exists in another dimension.
Yeah. Yeah, and with her character in particular, as you say, the Log Lady is sort of like the spine of the Twin Peaks universe or something like that.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a couple things in this that I think are worth mentioning leading into. One of them is her saying, you know, my log is turning gold.
Yeah.
In Secret History of Twin Peaks, we hear the idea that the log speaks to her. We've seen that in the series and such. But in Secret History, it kind of points out that she might believe that the log is her dead husband that died in a fire.
Well, I always thought that.
And
so.
Was represented. Okay. So, but if this is her husband and it's turning gold and it's not talking to her anymore, this reminded me of a couple things. One is the idea that a chopped piece of wood, a log, processed tree,
right.
turned gold is maybe a metaphor for like the making the money off of the natural resource.
Okay, that's interesting.
And that also equates with the death of the log. And so I kind of was thinking, you know, possibly that's interesting
could
to analyze
be. Of
from
course,
there.
I was also thinking about a couple of other things. One would be alchemy.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And the fact that, you know, the idea was not just about trying to transmute elements into gold materially, but that the spiritual aspect of
yeah.
alchemy
yeah.
That was supposed to be at play there. And then also, of course, I thought about Jacobi's shovels.
Yeah. Quite interesting.
But yeah, the idea of the log turning gold, I'm not sure what to do with that, but it's
yeah.
something to think about.
And
yeah.
also last week we saw the scene with Lynch or Cole describing his dream where he dreamt about Monica Bellucci. And there's this moment where you would think it would be a character name, but it's actually the actress's name versus like you're pointing out
right.
Margaret Lanterman's name in, you know, the episode being dedicated to the character name versus
yeah.
the actual actress's name.
Yeah. So they're very self-consciously blurring those lines, right? All over the place. You know, also with the fact that, you know, the musical performers are, you know, put in as members of the cast, right? And all of that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, man. And then there's more because we go to Hawk sort of bringing everyone together in the conference room to tell them
yeah.
that she's died.
Yeah.
But first you pointed out, right, Frank's just sitting there alone looking at a fish.
Yeah, Frank's alone in the conference room
yeah.
looking at his laptop, and he's kind of engaged with the laptop too. But if you look close, he's just staring at a picture of a trout.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe it's his trout. Maybe he's investigating the mounting job and the colors, and did they preserve it well for him, or
yeah,
who knows? But
maybe,
it's
yeah.
interesting. And then Bobby and Andy and Lucy come in, and we find out that Hawk has called everyone together. As per this conversation we just heard, Margaret says to Hawk that Hawk does know about death, and she acknowledges, you know about death, it's just a change. And I also thought that part was interesting, too, that she acknowledges, hey, I'm just changing here. And
yeah.
like we've talked before about the possible, like, kind of almost therapeutic quality of the show, where Lynch is giving anybody out here, this is something we all have to deal with, right, basically.
Yeah.
And that's a really beautiful thought that helps a lot of people cope with death. And here we're seeing it with his actress, Catherine Coulson, who's been there from the very beginning.
Right.
And in fact, was there with Jack Nance from all the beginning and was working with them way early.
All the way back. And I mean, like, to the point where to think of her as an actress, well, it's something that happened through her connection to David Lynch, you know. And from what I've heard or read, him basically saying, oh, we're going to make a character for you.
Yeah.
You know, and that this idea of the log lady came into being and everything like that. So really intimate connection between her and Lynch and us.
And us, right. And to then have this scene carry over into Hawk bringing us all together in this moment of silence to pay homage to, actually, to Catherine Coulson in this moment.
Lucy says, you know, the log lady's dead.
Yeah, you mean the log lady's dead, right.
Puts her hands on the wood table.
Yeah, she reaches down, touches the wood. She's crying, tearing up. She kind of looks up a little bit. There's this moment where Frank takes his hat off. Hawk bows his head. And we get the feeling, at least I did, that the Log Lady was a protective force. She was this good energy that was there protecting everybody. And and just how sad to lose that good-natured force, that Catherine was always sharing the truth and was always insightful and always kind of had a higher understanding of things that were going on.
Yeah.
When she called in and made these statements all through the original series too, it was always this really profound statement. And even the head, the sheriff, and even Cooper and everybody that knew her took her as an extreme authority on these things, not to be dismissed, you know? And then now that we are losing her, there's a bow of the head. So it's a very sad moment for all fans and an homage moment for sure.
And you were pointing out, you thought there was at least some similarity here between the postures of Lucy and Andy and what we saw in Andy's vision.
Yeah, there were two things I thought that came from Andy's vision. One is when Hawk gets the call, we see the close-up of the phone in Andy's vision with the blinking light of the line that's the call. So we do see that and when Hawk gets the call. True. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, it's from Andy's vision.
Yeah.
And then by the time they're all gathering in the conference room, you see this moment where Andy kind of has his hands on Lucy's arms and Lucy's wearing some bizarre sweater. And she kind of like looks up. She doesn't look happy in her normal self, maybe a little sad or something, and then looks up a little bit pointed up. And that's also something we saw in Andy's vision. And so we did go back and we looked and we could tell it's definitely not the same footage.
It's not the same footage, So,
but it calls to it to me because of the kind of body language that I'm witnessing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, insofar as you're suggesting some resonance there or something like that. I guess my expectation is just that we will see that same footage. Lucy's dressed differently, I think, as well. And in Andy's vision, they seem to be in the hallway or something like that.
And similar to Andy last episode, I get the feeling that maybe Lucy and Andy might end up playing more of a role in a lot of this than we think. That there's some connection through them and their kind of purity and their love. And I'm feeling this way with Ed and Norma also.
Yeah.
There are certain players in this town that are, because they're filled with love, somehow are going to help fight the demons sort of thing.
But I kind of hope we're done with Ed and Norma, just because I feel like if there's more, it's going to be tragic.
I can see that.
I just want the happiness. Just leave it there.
Well, I could see, you know, be great. Like, a wedding in this, in a scene in the wedding or something happening.
But I doubt they're going to do that. Yeah. They already carried that scene out so long, with the shot to the sky and everything.
And with the Otis song in there, I mean, how much better can you
giving
make it?
Giving us all the moment, right? Because it was always, you know, it wasn't just that Ed and Norma had been pining for each other and were in love for years, but everyone in the audience, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I've ever talked to a person who watched that show who didn't want Ed and Norma to get together.
Yeah, exactly. You know? For sure. So in this moment, we're saying goodbye to Margaret Lanterman. There's this solid moment. I got the feeling that kind of we're losing a big ally in this fight that's brewing. And then we cut from this bowing of the head at the sheriff's office to the log lady's cabin with the light on.
Yeah, we go to the woods.
And we see the light go out.
The light goes out. And they really dwell with all of this. And it's sad.
It's a very sad moment.
Like fitting. Like they give it enough space for not just the notification of her death, but for the mourning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Really beautiful as well. So, and then so we cut to this to Audrey and Charlie. We're back to Audrey and Charlie.
Yeah, and one of the things that was most interesting to me is that the first couple of lines that Audrey says here are more or less repeating what she said the first time we saw her back in part 12.
Right. She says, I'm tired of waiting, basically.
I'm tired of waiting for the phone to ring, right? And she says she knows that Billy hated the Roadhouse, but let's go and check there.
Yeah.
And this was like the first thing she said in part 12. I mean, the wording might be a little different, but the ideas are exactly the same.
Yeah. And Charlie's standing there with his coat on and says, you know, of course I'm ready to go. I got my coat on. We're going to the Roadhouse.
And they're right by the door now.
Yeah.
Right. So we have another setting change.
But then at this, Audrey says something like, oh, you sure are something, Charlie. And Charlie says, you know, Audrey, put your coat on. I'm sleepy. Which I love when Charlie
I love when he
references
says he's sleepy.
His level of energy.
But then she's complaining about his complaining.
Right. And she says something like, stop being, it's like being with a sick dog or something, she says.
Yeah. When I go out with Billy, he doesn't do this.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'm Charlie.
And he's...
He is Billy.
She says, I prefer Billy.
Yeah, and he says, sensational. Right. Now, are you going to put on your coat?
Or am I going to die waiting here on the threshold?
Yeah. And she says, oh, you can't stop for 1 second. He says, well, in one fucking second, I'm taking my coat off.
Yeah.
You know, so he's actually getting these little practical, sarcastic shots in, even though his demeanor seems so calm and monotone.
Right.
You know, which is, I think, a great part of the character, actually.
Yeah, so a couple of things here. The word threshold stuck out to me, thinking back to the dweller on the threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that Hawk said to Cooper when he was talking about the lodges.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But also, as I mentioned, the repetition and the weird way in which it feels like we're getting the same scene, like different versions of the same scene.
Yes. Right.
Like every scene is about, are we about to go to the Roadhouse to look for Billy?
Right. And is this the same 20 minutes that has occurred through all three little chapters of this
Seen? You could put them together one after the other, I suppose. But at the same time, that they almost seem like different versions of the same event to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the first one, Charlie doesn't want to go.
Mm-hmm.
In the second one, Audrey says she's no longer sure if she wants to go.
Right.
She wants to do both.
Yeah.
Right. In the first one, Audrey wanted to go.
Yep.
In the second one, Audrey both wants to go and doesn't want to go.
Yes.
And then we have in the third one, her saying
Charlie's
she wants
more
to,
prepared to go.
She doesn't seem to want to go.
Yeah.
Right? Like, Charlie's ready to go, and now Audrey's the one who is not going.
But it's like Audrey wants to go, but she wants to go in the right conditions that still have not been met.
In the right way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because she says something like, it's
impossible.
Why are
you so impossible, Charlie? Yeah.
And she's like, I see it. It's right here before my eyes. And he's like, what is it now, Audrey?
Yeah.
And she says, you. I never saw you the way I see you now. It's like meeting a different person. And she says to him,
Who are you, Charlie?
Yeah. And then Audrey, and then you think he's going to come back with like some answer to that, but no, he's like, okay, off comes the coat. And he goes and he turns and sits down. It's more than he's willing to get into, I guess.
She goes to kind of strangle him and, you know,
she straight up attacks him. Yeah. How can you be like this? I hate your fucking guts. Do you know how much I hate you? And actually goes to strangle him and we get a quick cut. So we don't see how she gets calmed down or if she does actually.
Right. And I half expect next time we see Audrey, like probably like next week, you know, it'll be back to her standing somewhere with her coat.
Yeah, they'll be on the porch maybe. Like,
should we go look for Billy at the Roadhouse?
Right.
So like, what the fuck is going on?
Meanwhile, the reality unravels.
Yeah.
You know?
We talked about, and certainly a lot of people out there are talking about various theories. There's the big coma theory, which I don't think either of us really likes.
I'm not really buying that one.
No.
There's several theories, and I could see how several of them could work.
Yeah.
I think you phrased it very well, where it's just like, well, maybe we're done guessing. I just want to wait and to see what they're going to give us about this.
It's like I'm willing to express like negative judgments, right? Like, I don't think she's still in a coma. And I have various reasons
for that. The psychiatric one makes the most sense to me.
Yeah.
If they talked about a contract previously. Maybe that contract is something Ben Horn has worked out with Charlie, and Charlie is a caretaker. They've said they've been married, but neither of them are wearing rings. You know,
yeah. I mean, I guess I could see that, but I don't think it's that. I just don't think it's that.
I don't either.
It doesn't feel right.
Yeah. And then there's other people to say, well, can it just be what they're saying? Like, okay, so they're married. They don't like each other. They stayed married. They don't wear rings. Charlie's always sleepy and knows that his wife is cheating on him.
But doesn't care.
But doesn't really care too much. Maybe he's a nihilist and he's just too busy with all his paperwork.
He says.
Yeah, sensational.
I'm sleepy.
Yeah.
And what happened to his paperwork? So it's a little too weird to just feel like normal reality. So I kind of feel like they're going somewhere with all of this that we honestly just can't predict.
Yeah.
Which makes me feel way more excited about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Just how this is all going to wrap up is actually really exciting because we are so entangled right now, all these characters entangled with each other and the storylines. We don't know if we're witnessing parallel universes and characters that exist outside of the space-time continuum of other characters, and now we've witnessed characters with superhuman strength, like literally metaphysical superheroes. And so, you know, it's getting pretty crazy. What the hell is going to happen? On top of which, we've seen these crazy characters like the drunk and the kid in the car who are suffering from some weird malady. You know, so where the heck are we going? And now that Dougie's been electrocuted with, you know, as much voltage as he has, maybe we'll see something.
Yeah.
So Charlie and Audrey, we did see them again, but just like you were saying earlier, it takes us up to that point, but we still actually don't get any answers. Yes, yeah. Audrey is the mother of Richard Horn. So what That's else do we got. Know? That's it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So from here to the Roadhouse.
Yeah, the Vales. So we get the Vales are singing. It's this band at the Roadhouse singing. There is some...
Cool song. I enjoy the song.
Yeah, the song is good. There are some elements in the song lyrically that I think were very noticeable and applicable to what's going on. You get lines like unelemental chemicals,
yeah,
which reminded me of the Chinese sparkle drug that they keep referring to, right?
Right, and the title's referring to like kind of salamander, right?
Well, the song's called Axolotl, which is a strange salamander, but a very unique one that's like usually exists in caves and freshwater, but will have the kind of like a weird dragon head. It has these frills on it. So it's a very unique, it's one of the more unique animals that are on Earth. And, you know, as we see this, there's also, of course, we were talking about all the different types of animals represented in these weird ways, though.
Zebra,
rhinoceros, zebra, the penguin, you know, what are all these animals being referenced? But they're all unique and also animals that aren't of the region, really, outside of maybe bunnies and owls. So turning me into black tentacles is what the unelemental chemicals are going to do in the lyrics, you know?
Yeah, and then you mentioned also, right, there's a reference to Bob Dylan in there, right?
Yeah, there is a quote from Subterranean Homesick Blues. Says, you know, Maggie's coming in with soot on her face. The Vales actually changed the line a little bit. Instead of just soot on your face, they say there's a baby with soot in the stomach.
Yeah.
A belly full of soot. Mm-hmm. A baby with a belly full of soot. And of course, soot reminds us of the Woodsman characters. But that's also a Bob Dylan quote that, as we've seen, Lynch slipping in different quotes and different like kind of homages to
and
all the great
song
artists
has all kinds
of his
little
time.
Thematic things. The Dylan song, I mean, has all kinds of thematic things that you could tie into. Right?
Oh, yeah, like, whether it's the badge reference or...
Is it, like Johnny's in the basement thinking about the government, right? Mm-hmm. Or
and just
like
using the name Maggie, short for Margaret, and we've, of course, just seen Margaret Lanterman pass away, you know, and Maggie with soot on her face, you know, so... There's definitely a couple references worth mentioning there. But there's this whole scene that unfolds during this band performing, right? We see a young lady sitting at the booth that we always see, but this time it's just one young lady.
Yeah, and apparently her name is Ruby. And she's sitting there alone, and she doesn't look particularly into the performance or anything like that.
Yeah, she's kind of dazed or depressed or lost in thought or something.
And these biker guys come over, and she says, "I'm waiting for someone."
Yeah, they proceed to like pick her up and set her on the ground, which I love this action. So first of all, it's you could take it almost as innocuous, but it's incredibly violent. It's completely overriding her will.
Completely not okay.
It's completely not okay. It's using force. It's using power and saying, "Look, we're going to do this because we're more powerful than you. You have no say in the matter." Yeah. Incidentally, when the bikers walk up, one of them gives a nod to the biker sitting in the next booth over, who's got a broken arm.
Right.
Just to mention.
I mean, they just pick this girl up and they set her on the floor. And so, all right, again, this is not okay. Don't do this. But I have to apologize and admit I did laugh.
Yeah, because if it's awkward, right? Yeah. Because it's something that you don't quite see. And it's also like, to me, I actually was thinking this is like somehow a young inheritor of the being the log lady or something.
Yeah, you thought her style
like the glasses,
similar,
the hair, the sweater.
Yeah,
I sort of thought like very, very similar. And then they pick her up and they put her down on the wood floor and she's crawling across the wood, touching the wood. And then she has this moment where she has this like incredibly hysterical scream,
which is great,
which is great. I mean, and she, of course, this is around all the other people dancing and we're cutting back and forth between the band playing. But here's this character that's like completely in the middle of this social scene and is suffering. And I thought at first, okay, this is kind of like social, completely being humiliated by being picked up and set down on the floor.
Right.
But then what was she dealing with in that moment and who is she waiting for?
Yeah.
Is she maybe on the drugs or was she depressed or, you know, that, or was that just too much socially from these assholes that think they can do whatever they want?
I mean, you know.
Because they're stronger.
Right.
And
the world, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, doesn't the world just make you want to scream sometimes or like, well, there was some Onion article in the past few months about something like more and more women are quitting their jobs to spend more time lying face down on the floor.
Yeah. I saw that, actually. Like, that's funny. Yeah.
It was kind of reminded me of something like that, you know? And here you have, she's just sitting at the booth. She has every right to sit there. And you have these two fucking guys come and pick her up and just set her on the floor.
Yeah.
That being said, I did just have the vibe that there was something a bit more metaphysical maybe at play here.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, for sure.
But I love the cut, the scream, and then the quick cut to the credits.
Quick cut to Kyle MacLachlan, the credits, and now we're seeing back to the motel parking lot.
Yeah, so the style is like similar but different, again, from what we've seen in the past, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things I've always noted is how when we do end with the Roadhouse performance, I can always kind of feel when it's about to say starring Kyle MacLachlan. Like, it always hits at this point in the music, right?
Yeah.
It's like the climax.
I think it's well planned
right?
each
like
time.
Throw the tape recorder into the bathtub at the climax. White Rabbit Peaks.
Mm-hmm.
But here it was very similar to that, but says distinctly different.
Yeah.
Like the song does continue.
Song continues. There's a couple weird like video game sample blips, mm-hmm. kind of like level up, power up kind of moments that you hear, like, that's awkward. I guess the Veils just threw that in their song. I'd also like to point out a little shout out to LP, who produced this on the Def Jux label, which is awesome to see LP and Def Jux involved with Lynch and Frost. That's really rocking my world. I love that. Also the collaboration between a hip hop artist and kind of a rock, modern rock band.
Yeah.
And that's cool to see. And so what we get as this song kind of fades out is the shot of the motel.
Right, the credits roll.
The credits roll. Course, we get right near the end of the credits.
We're paying attention to the credits we see in there, right? That Nathan Frizzell is credited as the voice of Philip Jeffries, for example.
Correct. And that it's dedicated to Margaret Lanterman.
It's dedicated to Margaret Lanterman. And the music continues. And then towards the end, right, there's an edit in what we're seeing.
Yeah, before the credits end, what's behind them, there's an edit that changes angles from looking straight on to Philip Jeffries' number 8 hotel room door.
Right, where we were before.
To, like, kind of over to the right side of that, where was the character name credited as?
Bosomy Woman.
Bosomy Woman is kind of standing in a little dark garage area in the background.
Right, and as I was saying to you, I don't know what other people's experiences might have been here. But I didn't see her at first, right? Because you have the text on the screen.
Yeah.
I noticed the cut in the background image,
right?
That there was a difference. But I was still kind of looking at the words, you know, kind of like reading the names of the songs and that kind of shit that's towards the end. And I didn't see her until the words stopped. So for me, it was like this quick second, like, jump out of my chair moment of, you know, horror movie.
Yeah, so the credits finish going up, and we see, oh, shit, there's that woman.
There's that woman.
And that's the scariest part of the episode I just saw. That's a little freaky right here
cuts,
at the end. And then,
right,
bam.
Then it cuts to Lynch Frost.
Lynch Frost.
Yeah.
It's and I'm like, oh, Jesus.
Like,
we
what
literally,
a stinger,
we both literally jumped out of our chair in fright as a jump scare moment.
That was great.
Right at the very end, though, doing it with your logo. And, you know, it's not the scary monster in the story scaring you. It's the freaking logo of the guys that made this is what scared the shit out of me after we're done with the narrative. That's just such a cool, like expanding and like stepping back from a production and kind of viewing, like, so what can we do with this whole medium now?
Yeah.
You know, and they've pulled a number of maneuvers that tell me they're really thinking smart about camera work, about lighting, about new drone technology, about, like, getting processing footage using CGI and stuff like this. And I think this is one of those moments where they're very consciously like, you know what? Let's do that little scary moment and right there. And I was jumped out of my chair. It did frighten me. So
really, really cool.
And what a great way to end an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're winding down. We got one more episode before the finale, right? So 3 more hours of this thing.
Right. It's because they're airing part 17 and 18 together.
Yeah.
So, only 2 weeks in real time.
Yeah, and I can't wait to find out what's going to happen.
Oh, me neither.
I'm really.
But then I'm also, like, going to be sad when
I feel it already. Yeah, when this is over. And what are our chances that somehow it'll get picked up and turned into one of these Game of Thrones types where we get it for several years, maybe.
I really do have the feeling that it's kind of on Lynch. Right?
I think it is. And I think he would generally, I mean, who knows, but really. But I would imagine for the integrity of it or something, he wouldn't let it run on for that many seasons.
Well, and I wouldn't think that he would hand it over to someone either at this point. He wants to preserve Twin Peaks. So if there was going to be more, And I guess this is what I would want too, right? If there's going to be more asked to be Lynch and Frost,
yeah,
doing it like they're doing it now.
Yeah, I agree.
So do they want to do it?
Yeah. But it could be something totally different. I could picture some sort of offshoot or something. I mean, imagine just like Tammy and her task force tackling metaphysical FBI shit. Like, or, you know, we've talked about it. There are a number of things that you could do, like,
I'd
just theoretically.
Down. I'd be down. Okay,
as
like,
a fun offshoot, you know, to come from the show.
I would be fine with if, like, David Lynch didn't want to do it to this extent, but Mark Frost wanted to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Frost was the showrunner of a show that was, like, Tammy Preston investigates Blue Rose cases.
That would be so
and
awesome.
Maybe Lynch directed an episode here or there, yeah. And like maybe other people direct. I'd be fine with it. I'd totally do it.
Yeah,
I'd totally watch
and
it.
And that could exist from a number of different characters too. If you think about it, I mean, you could have like
we'll be the
Sheriff Bobby Briggs on the beat, you know, or whatever. There's a number of ways that you could have another show that would, you know, branch out from this one. It'd be very interesting.
I was also thinking. Part of me was hoping. You know, I was like, you know, what Lynch and Frost really should do. Instead of making more Twin Peaks, as they should reboot On the Air.
That would be interesting.
But then I realized we can't because we lost Miguel Ferrer. I don't think you can do it.
Yeah.
Maybe you can do something else with Ian Buchanan. But I mean, just because On the Air was such a failure,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be hilarious if they were like, let's do that again.
Yeah.
Let's. You know.
But either way, our plea, our sincere plea in one form or another is that we still keep getting new Lynch and Frost. In motion pictures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, what a great episode, action-packed. We can't wait to see what's going to happen. And just incidentally, today was the day of the eclipse, as you mentioned earlier.
It was indeed, yeah.
And we didn't see any vortexes or anything. I was kind of bummed out, actually. After watching Twin Peaks, I was like, this eclipse isn't really doing it.
A little bit of a letdown, yeah.
Compared to where I've been.
Like, that's cool, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, join us next week. Cameron, it's always awesome talking to you, man.
Awesome talking to you, too.